When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Story Studio. Oh yeah, here we go. Check it out now.
Welcome to the Story Studio, a podcast where an independent publishing company explores the world of self-publishing, independent art, and a bit of the old future of storytelling. My name is Luke Kondo with a K, and I'm joined by my regular co-host, Mr.
Daniel Wilcox.
How's it going, man? You're right?
I'm good. Was that an oxymoron?
What?
What a good bit of the old future of storytelling.
It was, yeah. You got to keep them guessing. You don't want anyone to know exactly what you mean.
No, it works. I'm good. How are
say,
you?
Yeah, you could say I was giving them a cipher.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is that a segue? Or are we waiting for the big book?
I guess it is. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, have you got a big book for us, Daniel?
Yeah. So I've been busy beavering away like a little chipmunk. At Cypher, which is going to be
an oxymoron, beavering like a chipmunk.
It's a bit oxymoron. I don't know if it's just absolute madness, but
yeah.
So when was it? It must have been around March or April time. I started speaking about doing a Sideways podcast, which was 7 episodes of a story. Didn't know what it was going to look like. And then since then, I've just been kind of milling the idea away in my head, I think, just letting it ruminate. And as of about a month ago, yeah. It's gonna be one of those evenings, as about a month ago, maybe 6 weeks ago, decided to actually get my head down, start getting the production, get everything ready to go. So me and Carl Hughes, our audio editor for the other stories, have been hard at work with 4 pretty fantastic actors to put together a Kickstarter for Cypher, which is not like the Pokemon, but like Cypher.
Which one is the Pokemon?
Is that it's the green Scizor? One with like the swords on its arms.
It evolves into Scizor.
Yes.
Yeah, I used to really like Cypher.
He's my favorite first gen Pokemon.
Yeah, yeah.
Easy.
Very
cool.
Badass.
Yeah. But and so everything is set to go live, which if you're listening on this, will be this coming Monday. No, coming Wednesday, 1st of November. Everything will be live. If you want to get your hands on the 7 episode of Cypher before anyone else in the whole wide world, then pledge and get involved, because it's going to be fun. If the show funds, it will happen. If it doesn't fund, it doesn't happen. Lots of people are sad, but we just move on with our lives, I guess. But yeah, it's going to be...
Yeah,
it's exclusive to Kickstarter for a fair few months, and then potentially down the way we'll probably make it public for release, but you get that exclusive first look at the show.
Yeah, it's like getting a Netflix subscription, but like a Netflix instant thing that's only available on Netflix for a while, and then you download it illegally.
Okay. And then, and there is an early bird special at £10 for the entire show.
Cool.
So there's a limit to get your hands on them. But yeah, what about you? What's your big hoop?
So keeping in the theme of audio stuff, Tom Robson sent me a YouTube video of a 3D audio haircut. Have you listened to it? Have you?
Yeah, I think actually that circulated around my school a few years back.
Well, I got the feeling it was old, but I've never heard it before. And so the idea is that you put these headphones on, and it's they've recorded a room binaurally, which means they've basically got 2 microphones that act as the 2 ears, so left and right, panning left and panning right of the room. And if you record that way and then listen back, it gives a full 3D effect of the room, so you can hear where people are around the room in relation to where you are. And in this demo, they've done like a haircut idea, so it's like they've got like clippers and scissors moving around your head, and it's weird because you can feel it going all the way around your head, and like it's pretty good. And Kat, my fiance, listened to it, and she jumped, like screamed at the last bit, because like there's like a little whisper, like out of nowhere, a little whisper in the ear right at the end. And we got talking. We were like, wow, imagine like a little horror story told in that binaural method, that binaural way. You could do really cool with that.
If you sat in, say you sat in the center of a room and there's some people, I don't know, like fighting or doing stuff around you,
We could do those. Yeah. You could do a seance table. So you could do like, and like have like ghosts talking around your ears. You could have the medium on the other side, you know, talking in tongues and stuff. There's so many things you can do. So I've been looking into that. I figured that's a cool experiment maybe in the future.
Excuse my weird outburst, and I just had someone else call me literally as we were talking.
was it a spirit? Is that a?
It was a spirit.
Okay, that's good.
An absolute spirit. That stuff's cool. Like, is it that cheesy Italian one where the guy's like, "We're going to do your head card." Yeah. There's a part in that I'm pretty sure where like there's music playing in the background.
Yeah, the guy like playing live guitar in the corner. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember when I listened to it. I was just sat in my bedroom, eyes closed, because I got told to plunge yourself into experience.
Yeah.
And that freaked me out. I full on thought that someone was in my room at that point.
Weird, isn't it? It's weird how effective it is. But now, the more I think about it, the more I think I would love to do a special episode of The Other Stories using that recording method. You'd have to actually have people in the room, like almost like a stage play, though, as you do it.
You could really do it separately.
I think maybe you can manipulate audio. Yeah, well, I think maybe you'd have to have like a bass line, and then maybe you could put, special effects. You'd have to experiment, but I'm not too sure. But anyway, enough of all that. Today, I think we've got our guests sort of waiting for us now.
Yes.
I won't linger too long, but just... I hope it'll be a good interview. You haven't recorded it yet, so
well, we're always
on. I'm sure it'll be good. Yeah, so we'll have to wait and see. We'll find out when you find out.
Cool. And over to our interview with John Cronshaw.
Cool.
So today we're talking to John Cronshaw. John is a British science fiction and fantasy author based in Morecambe, England, who is rocking the post-apoc world with his book series, The Wizard of the Wasteland. He also works as a freelance features writer. He has had work published in local and national newspapers across the UK, including The Metro, Yorkshire Post and The Guardian. He's a voracious reader, guide dog owner, ex-gamer and certified geek. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, John.
Hey, how's it going?
How does one get a certification for the geekerage? Is that how did you get that?
I mean, it was one of them unaccredited universities that you get online. I basically answered an email thing and paid $3,000 for it, but you know, it's definitely worth it. So.
Yeah, it's a similar way to how you own a piece of the moon. You pay for some of it. Yeah.
So, money is power.
Yeah, John, I was on your website the other day, and I saw this little, really interesting little piece here, and I just thought I'd quickly read it out because I think it's a good start to the interview. You put here, "To pay my bills, I work as a journalist. I've met interesting and powerful people, the Prime Minister, the Chancellor, Boris. I've listened to the stories of dying kids, drag queen wrestlers, reformed addicts, artists, writers, bishops and liars. I've sat in courtrooms, council chambers and inquests. I've seen so many different sides and so many different people, their passions, their schemes, their pettiness and selflessness. Journalism has been an education in the human condition, a rich and vivid mosaic of stories, all valid, all unique, all fantastic in their own way." I read that and I was like, wow, that's quite a wellspring of experiences to write stories and create characters from. Can you sort of start by telling me a little bit about yourself as a journalist and these crazy experiences you've had?
Yeah, I mean, it's I don't know where to start, really. I mean, yeah, I've worked in newspapers and things. I mean, it was mainly local news that I worked in, Halifax Courier and like the Yorkshire Evening Post and places like that. So it was, you know, down kind of right on the bottom level, doing the articles about court, you know, going to courtrooms and reporting on whatever was going on that day, you know, magistrates court, Crown Court, and then ended up becoming a political reporter. And then that kind of led to, what was it, in the 2015 election, the Tories happened to launch their election campaign in Halifax, and it was like one of those main kind of bellwether seats, so they really wanted Halifax, so they were there, and I got to interview all these people who were, you know, the faces of Labour and the Tories. So it was, I don't know, felt like I was really kind of in the middle of stuff as all this stuff was going on. So no, it was really exciting. And it's just, you get to see all these different things and you have to do so many different jobs on a day-to-day basis. I mean, even doing the political reporting, I was, you know, I'd do the kind of council meetings and, you know, looking at what the local NHS were doing and reading through documents. And then I'd have to go to a local primary school to speak to some kids who had like heart conditions and stuff. So it was like all the time just speaking to different people with different, you know, different things going on. And yeah, I just think doing that has given me a really good sense of what people do, how people talk, and just great, you know, just so much ammunition for characters.
It's
amazing. And are you still doing that now?
No, not as much as I was. I mean, I was doing freelance for a while and I've basically turned into kind of full-time dad / author. You know, I'm doing this now and looking after my son, you know, when I'm not writing. So, yeah, it's that's how it's going. And, you know, the Wasteland series is just starting to sell enough now where, you know, I can justify that going forward.
Right.
So what was your kind of switch between the journalism and into the more fiction side, I guess, because the writing styles are very, very different, aren't they? It's a lot more formal when you're doing your journalism stuff against your creative fiction.
Well, I thought I could write. So, you know, I've been doing the journalism and I thought, oh, well, it's a piece, isn't it? You just write. And I couldn't, so I had to teach myself again. So I did a lot of things, you know, learning craft and, you know, I must have watched all of, you know, Brandon Sanderson's lectures and gone through all the Writing Excuses episodes. I mean, I just did a kind of my own MFA in creative writing. And then I did the, the Avron courses that they do. I don't know if you're aware of those. They're like basically go for a week in Ted Hughes's house and learn how to write. And I did mine with Jeff Ryman and Simon Ings. And Jeff Ryman is one of my favourite authors. So it was just like, I got to spend a week with him and learn how to write. And it was just that experience. Like then, that was 2 years ago, actually. And that was just, that was the switch. That was the point where I was just like, I need to do this. This is what I need to do. I've been working on a novel for about a year and a half. It will never see the light of day. It was rubbish, but I needed to kind of get it out of my system and do it. I think that happened. And then I had a job. I basically got a very good job that was working as a basically like a Malcolm Tucker kind of character. I don't know if you watched Thick of It.
Yeah.
Basically a press secretary for someone in the shadow cabinet. And it turned out that...
Was that in your job description?
Basically, she wouldn't let my guide go for a wee one day, so I walked out. and I've never walked out of a job before. So, that was insane. So I was just kind of like, now what? So I spent half the time doing freelance work and then doing fiction writing and probably had about 3 failed attempts at novels and then kind of hit on what I'm doing now. So, yeah, it's just been a real kind of education and...
Yeah.
Just a lot of, you know, hours sitting in front of a computer and writing.
Yeah. So the first novel where you thought, okay, this is, I'm onto it now. Is that like a post-apocalyptic novel or is that another one?
The first one that I wrote that I thought actually this works is what I released as my second novel, which is Night of the Wasteland.
Yeah.
And then I wrote a prequel to that, which was called Addict to the Wasteland, which I kind of did the Insta freebie thing. So it was a novella length rather than a novel. And then I did this short story that was called Wizard of the Wastes, which was, it came to me in a dream, this idea of this wizard kind of visiting this post-apocalyptic town. And he just kind of showed off old technology, making out that it's kind of, you know, something magical when, you know, he's just showing off light bulbs and things like that. And then I thought, oh, I could fuse this with the Wasteland thing. So then ended up writing Wizard of the Wasteland as the first book in that series. So yeah, it's crazy.
That's cool. And how did it feel to publish that, to get your fiction out there onto the store?
Yeah, amazing. It's it's really, really cool. And it's you know, I've had my work published for years. I've had articles and whatever published, but there was something really magical about knowing that somebody had read my story And, you know, I'll get emails from people who've read my stories and get what I'm trying to do, because I know that my stuff isn't necessarily as commercial as a lot of the post-apocalyptic fiction that you'll see. I've made a lot of mistakes in terms of writing in, I don't know, present tense, for example. You know, I won't do that again.
Was that just for that first book?
For the series, I'm kind of sticking with style. Which is kind of third person, limited, very limited. You don't go into the person's head. It's present tense. My style, I've tried to emulate Ernest Hemingway, which is probably really lofty and probably not the best idea for selling commercial fiction. So, yeah, I mean, it's all an education, and it's all kind of learning what I can do with stories and what I can do with words. So.
Didn't Nick Cole do that with Old Man in a Wasteland? I've not actually read it, but I was under the impression that he wrote.
I think he did, didn't he? I think it was like his riff on Old Man of the Sea, and there was a lot of weird stylistic choices in that, which, you know, I love that kind of stuff. You know, I love people who mess around with language and things like that. But, you know, this is, for me now, this is a business, and I need to kind of think of the reader first and not just myself. So,
yeah.
Coming back, if we pause a little bit and look back at, so you said you've been kind of in this game for about 2 years, and from where I first saw you was sort of all littered over Facebook, when I've seen your books popped on a load of different groups. I've seen you releasing your second one, obviously your third one will be coming out very, very soon. What's the date for that one?
It's the 28th of October, so it's, Saturday.
So if you're listening on launch day, it's tomorrow. but yeah, so you've got all of this stuff kind of going out. But what was it in that first couple of years that, one, took you so long to publish? And I don't mean that in a cruel way, because, you know, everyone, that's not what it's meant. But one, to actually get to that point where you could publish. But two, in terms of the actual process and what you wanted to do, because I know some people have that inner battle between whether they want to do the commercial fiction, whether they want to put something out they love. And I know that my first book was just a labor of love. I didn't want anything else from it, and it served me well. But what was your kind of process in those first couple of years?
Yeah, so, I mean, it's having direction. You know, I learned about plot structure, and that was a revelation for me. It's weird. I had a look over, because I back everything up. I've got into the habit of that for years. And I looked over my creative writing folder the other day, and I realized that actually I tried to write a dystopian novel in 2007 that didn't go anywhere. so I've been doing stuff like this for years. You know, I had ideas for comics and just all these kind of different things. I'd written a comedy script, a radio play, and it's just, I'd written all these things that I just thought, oh, this is crap once I'd done it. And then I wrote this, I had this kind of really ambitious idea for a novel, which was basically, I kind of envisioned it a bit like Game of Thrones in space. So it was set in a kind of post-Earth solar system, and it ended up having like 13 point of view characters, and it was just a mess, and it didn't really go anywhere. And I spent ages on it. I got developmental edit from Cat Howard on part of the story, and, you know, getting line edits when I was halfway through. I just didn't know what I was doing at all. But I finished it, and it was dreadful, and it's an unrepairable mess. But I'm glad I did it.
You should do a Richard Bachman. You should release it in a pseudonym, and it will take off.
You know what?
I
have released parts of it, because there were so many characters. It was basically, I don't know, maybe 13 short stories almost woven together that all kind of cross over. Released a couple of them as short stories and kind of honed them and kind of made them pretty and, you know, made them into a more of a, you know, better story arc. So I have released some of the things as short stories in like my collections and things. So, you know, there's bits of it out there, but I don't know. I just got so trapped in that. And then I decided for a while to do things where I put things in a bag. Like, I wrote things down on a label thing, put it in a bag, shook it up, picked it out, picked two things, and tried to do a kind of X meets Y. And I think I picked something weird like Lion King meets Meerkat Manor. and so I ended up writing, I got into like 17,000 words of this like dystopian story about meerkats, and I just thought, what the fuck am I doing?
I made a terrible mistake. It reminds me of David Bowie, because that's how you wrote song lyrics. You used to just
Well, I think that's it. You know, I've been in bands in the past, and you know, experimental bands, and done art, you know, whatever. So, so it's kind of all these things coming in to the ideas, and then I don't know. I've been world building a epic fantasy thing for about the past 5 years as well, I realise. So I just needed to kind of get something out there to prove to myself that I could write a story and it be a full story and be, you know, half decent and be professionally, you know, like a professional thing that you would buy in a shop. So, I did that and people seemed to like it. So, yeah, that was good.
So, what brought you to indie publishing rather than taking the books to a traditional, than the traditional route? You maybe did that as well. I'm not too sure.
Not at all. I used to, like, years and years ago. I mean, this was probably 2007. Now I ran a self-published magazine, and used to do all the printing and everything. And one of the people who was the she was a deputy editor. She was like one of the kind of early authors on Kindle, someone called LKJ, and I think she still publishes actually, but you know, she was one of the first adopters and just talking about how amazing it was. And then I knew people who'd been published and picked up by presses, and you know, were in battles about getting the rights back and just getting really frustrated. And I just thought, because of the way I am, I like to have control of what I'm doing. I like to control my own destiny. I've got a disability. So, you know, sometimes I can't be on as much as I want. So I just needed something, a way to do this in a way that was on my terms. And this, doing it in the indie way, it just kind of speaks to me as, you know, someone who's done kind of DIY bands in the past and all this kind of stuff. It all makes sense. So,
yeah. It's strange. It reminds me, I mean, a lot of these people who make like indie comics and, you know, were in bands growing up, I feel like a lot of them have a similar sort of mindset, that whole DIY, just do something. But like the whole kind of punk rock sort of way of doing things. I know a lot of indie comic makers were in bands. Did you play in bands as well? Or were you?
Yeah. No, I played in bands and had a bit of success with a band that I was in that was actually a kind of take the piss band. Me and a friend of mine did a band that was a fake German band called Die Plankton. And it was just, we said that we were the pioneers of new kraut rock, and just ended up, we started off doing it just to kind of troll the Muso kind of scene in Leeds. And we ended up playing in like the Tate Gallery in Liverpool and all this kind of stuff. So it was, it just kind of took on its own, thing. So yeah, I mean, just stuff like that, the fact that you can do something that's stupid and meaningless can have a big impact, you know, and actually get somewhere, I think that really inspires me. So I think that's the same with indie publishing.
Yeah, and I guess you're seeing a bit of that already. You already said that you're getting to a point where you're starting to see the rewards of the books that you've put out. Has that come from, are you currently working to any kind of publishing schedule? Do you have a kind of method to your approach now?
Yeah, I mean, it hasn't meant to be, but I mean, I released Wizard of the Wasteland in June, and then I released the next book in August. I've released this book, you know, in October. So, you know, with this trilogy, there's been a 2-month schedule. I'm not going to be able to sustain that because, you know, there's no point in me releasing a fourth book, you know, around Christmas. So what I'm doing is, I'm going to get this I'm working on a collaborative trilogy with two other people, which is like a UK-based post-apocalyptic thing. We're calling it Black Death, and then I think we're going to have like, you know, a word probably after it, like Black Death Annihilation, or, you know, those kind of a series like that. And it's basically set in the UK, post-apocalyptic setting. It's after the end of antibiotics, and the Black Plague is back, the Black Death is here. And so it's all set in the UK. A lot of cool stuff going on in terms of cultural references and, you know, very specific places. All the places are real and, you know, places I've lived and things like that. And the other people who are writing it have lived and been to as well. So I'm working on that over the next few weeks. I'm almost done with the first book, which has taken just over a fortnight to do my first draft, which is
awesome. How many words are you doing a day?
we're doing well. I mean, it fluctuates with me. I prefer to see it on a kind of monthly thing. So I try to get 30,000 to 40,000 words a month if I can. Sometimes that'll be more. Like I wrote Night of the Wasteland. I think the first draft of that I did in about 10 days. So it just depends. What I'm looking to do is get the first draft of this trilogy done for the early December, and then I want to start working on the fourth Wasteland book, which will probably be the last one in that series. And then there's a really difficult book that I've been working on the side, which is a kind of lit RPG, but the main character he's got a implant in his mind, so he can implant in his brain so he can perceive this virtual world, but in the real world he's blind. And I'm visually impaired, and I'm having to play with a lot of my own kind of experiences as, you know, growing up and coping with being visually impaired and what that means and all those issues. So it's like there's two kind of weird hero's journey parallel stories going on. So it's actually really difficult to write just because it is so kind of personal, but I think it'll be really good when it's done, because it is, you know, very honest and, you know, written from a perspective that not a lot of people have firsthand. So
yeah, I like that. 30,000 words, 30,000 words, 30,000 to 40,000 words a month is achievable. Like I think anyone can do 30,000 words like a month. It's not, that's what, 1,000 words a day. That's kind of what I'm doing at the minute, and it's the kind of word count where it's not, it doesn't feel hard. Like it doesn't feel like you're trying. It doesn't feel like you've got a mountain to climb. You're just sort of sitting down at the computer for half an hour, and it's almost enjoyable.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I write 4 days a week on creative stuff, so I think that's probably works out about 20 hours I can spend writing. So, that's kind of how that works out over a week.
Yeah. So your project where you're working with other authors, is it deliberate that they're all UK-based authors? Because, I mean, obviously with the internet being how it's being, it's possible to work with anyone anywhere.
Yeah, well, I mean, this is it. I mean, one of the authors is actually lives in Canada and has lived in New Zealand and just happens to have been raised in Somerset. I'm not sure how long it's been since he's actually lived here, you know. The other one lives in Northern Ireland, and obviously I've lived quite a few places in the UK. So the internet is just amazing for this. I was thinking about this the other day, that the idea of doing this, you know, even 10 years ago would have been really challenging. And, you know, we're on Facebook Messenger all the time and we've got some live Google Docs going on. And it's just amazing that this is coming together, and it's coming together so fast.
Yeah. And how are you finding the collaboration process? Because it must be a bit different too. Did you collaborate much as a journalist on anything? I imagine that you probably wouldn't so much.
You'd be surprised. You do. Because you have a news editor and you have people subbing your work, and you know, it's always a collaborative process. You've got to work with photographers, and you know, there's always people who you've got to deal with and work with. Sometimes you'll do an article where, you know, you might write the main story and then someone else who write a secondary story to it, a kicker to it, or, you know, there's different things going on where they'll be kind of linked, and you know, you always need other people to make stuff happen. The collaborative process has been really good. We decided to keep it really simple. We've got three point of view characters, we're all doing one each, we've got 20 scenes, and we've basically got a rough timeline saying, okay, scene 5 of book 1, the mobile phone networks go down, you know, scene 10, the electricity goes off. And, you know, so we've got these kind of rough things, and then we're kind of just doing our story and using the same kind of, I don't know if you're aware of Blake Snyder's save the cat method, you know, the kind of beat sheet where you hit certain thematic beats throughout a story. So we're kind of using that. We've got 20 scenes each for the first story. And I think what we'll probably end up doing is increasing that as we go through. Just kind of seeing how it goes. But I think we're averaging between 1,000 and 1,500 words per scene. So I think, you know, by the time we're done, we'll end up with, you know, something like a 70,000 word novel. And we started talking about the initial ideas for this about 4 weeks ago. and we're already halfway through the first book.
Yeah.
And we've already got ideas for publishing companies and, you know, we've set up.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
A lot of things in the background that are going to, you know, be important going forward. But yeah, it's just really cool how it's just worked so fast and worked so well.
Yeah, that sounds cool. And are you going to be doing, you say you're going to start up a bit of a small press. Are you going to be doing some conventions or getting out on the road at all?
Hopefully, you know, this is the thing with the kind of saying we're a small press and, you know, releasing all our titles under the banner and, I think it'll give us more kind of legitimacy when we, you know, apply for things, apply for conventions and things like that and, you know, get into other places in terms of getting reviews in newspapers and whatever. So I just think that there's a lot of advantages to doing it. And yeah, I think we're just going to go in and see what happens, really.
That's cool, man. I did want to quickly ask you about your extracurricular activities because I'm fond of a project, as it were, and I've seen you're doing the Ray Bradbury Challenge and you also got this Author Diary podcast. Can you quickly talk about the Ray Bradbury Challenge and what it is, why you're doing it, and, you know, what you got out of it?
Yeah, I mean, basically there's two Ray Bradbury Challenges. There was the one that I finished you know, a couple of months back, which is basically you write a short story every week for a year. And that was really great because it just gets you writing, it gets you thinking, and it gets you actually finishing stuff. And, you know, I've been able to release three short story collections that I wasn't intended to, which is just great to kind of have in a backlist when people look at your Amazon page. And, you know, I think I've basically had a release every 2 months now this year. So,
Wow.
That's been really good. So doing that was really rewarding. And, you know, I'm now just going to focus on doing the odd short story for things like anthologies. I mean, I'm doing one at the moment for an anthology with just a Facebook kind of group of authors that I'm on. And that's been a lot of fun. And the other part of the Ray Bradbury Challenge is the one where you read an essay, a poem and a short story every day for 1,000 days. Now I think I'm on about day 426, if I remember rightly. So I've been doing it for over a year now.
Yeah.
And it's amazing. It's really good. I mean, obviously, because of being visually impaired, when I say read, what I mean is I listen to a poem, I listen to, you know, audio podcasts, TED Talks, and, you know, the BBC's A Point of View and History of the World in 100 Objects, all these kind of different non-fiction things, and doing that, it's, you know, you're never short of ideas. You know, there's always different way because I'm trying to listen to things that I wouldn't necessarily listen to. So I'm listening to a lot of like literary fiction on the, you know, the New Yorker do fiction podcasts and they're great. And you know, there's young adult ones. I don't know if you know the Caster Wanders podcast, which is like young adult fantasy. So I'm experiencing all these different genres. I mean, you've got your podcast as well, The Stories. You know, listen to all these different podcasts and get all these different ideas. And it just kind of, I think it rounds me out more as an author because you kind of see, you get problems in writing in like, how do you do this? And if you're experiencing all these short stories and all these different writers who are good at maybe one thing or this thing and different genres, then you're going to hear the solutions to these problems. And I think that's really starting to filter into my work in terms of thinking about dialogue because, you know, I write in the science fiction genre and on the whole, it's my favourite genre, science fiction and fantasy, I love it. But when it comes to dialogue, they're not the strongest. Whereas you listen to something, a crime fiction story or something in literary fiction, and there's just something about the dialogue which punches you in the gut. It's like, right, I need to work out how they're doing that and bring it into my own work to kind of strengthen it. So, it's great.
Where are you sourcing all your articles and stuff from? Because I'd find that I've tried a few sort of RSS readers on my phone, and I tend to just then get preoccupied by Facebook when I'm trying to look for a decent article. So is there a place that you go to find all this stuff?
Well, as I say, it's mainly podcasts. I mean, I've got a few short story anthologies and things, but for things like, you know, TED Talks and, you know, thing like the recent podcast, Sincerely X, which is like a anonymous TED Talk kind of thing. And all the BBC ones, the BBC do the essay and the Reith lectures. And, you know, so it's all these kind of lectury podcasts or like opinion pieces. It's all that kind of stuff, really.
Could you, is there any sort of, any particular essay that stuck with your mind and any particular poem that stuck with your mind?
Yes, there was I might get the name wrong. It was The Ballad of Reading Jail, I want to say, by Oscar Wilde. That was an amazing poem, really horrible, really brutal, really dark. I recommend that. I listened to that through LibriVox.
Yeah.
And it was just about the brutality of prisons when Oscar Wilde was obviously in prison.
Yeah.
Just horrible imagery. Like I'm going to steal from that poem for years in terms of just getting horrible, gory imagery and things like that. I don't know. I mean, I think the essay thing, it's like it depends on what mood I'm in and what's inspired me recently. There was one, and I had a bit of a rant about this kind of thing on my podcast the other day. I mean, I don't like to get political on podcasts, but there were a couple of things that happened within a very short space of time that were relating to the kind of American really kind of militant political correctness movement that's going on.
Yeah.
And I'd read this article that someone had shared with me that was about what authors can and can't write about. And they're saying, you know, if you're straight, include gay characters, but you can't write about what it's like to be gay because you don't understand the oppression. And I just went through this list. It's like, it's like, I'm sorry, but the whole point of fiction is being able to empathize and understand the other. And I think I that really made me angry. And there was like there was a BBC's A Point of View podcast that was about essentially saying that this movement is using free speech as
authoritarian leftist movements. Yeah, it's crazy.
Yeah, so
it's like the progressionist left are like using, I don't want to get political either, but are like almost as militant and aggressive as the people they're trying to go against. It's weird. It's really weird.
Yeah, that was it. Free speech is a thing of male patriarchy, and so you have to have speech. It's like, no, because you're able to say that because of free speech. You know, there's a real contradiction there, and it frustrated me because, you know, I've written where I've got a character that is an interdimensional, you know, transcendental being, and it's like I've never had experience of that. I've never had experience of being a wizard in a post-apocalyptic world. You laugh, but you follow the logic, and that's where you get where you just can't. It's all going to be autobiography, and you can't actually write fiction because you can't write the other, and like that's what worries me. So yeah, I didn't want to go on a rant, but
that's cool. That's what
it fuels passion.
One of the things I'm pulling from this interview and also just from a lot of what I've seen of you on Facebook online is that you seem to be one of these people that you, rather than sitting around and waiting for opportunities, you tend to make a lot of opportunities. And I wanted to talk to you a little bit about your Facebook group. It is your Facebook group, isn't it?
Apocalypse one.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about your sort of your decision to start that group, what it's for, and also how it's helping you?
I think you've already said, it is this thing of, I grew up on a council estate in Wolverhampton, and the only way you could get out was through boxing, music, or education, I think. And people who didn't bother are still there, and you know, probably have had issues with heroin or, you know, that kind of thing. So you've got to make things happen. I hate it when you see people who go, I wish there was this, I wish there was that. And I've always just thought, well, if it's not there, do it. Mm. You know what I mean? I really wanted a community of like-minded authors who are writing in the same genre as me, who were willing to share and help each other and talk about craft and talk about how to raise the bar with what they're doing. And there are other post-apocalyptic groups on Facebook that, you know, do some really cool stuff, but it wasn't what I wanted. And so I just thought, you know what the hell, I will do this myself. I wanted to set up the group and, yeah, join the group. If you write apocalyptic stuff, if you write zombie stuff, if you write, dystopian stuff, there's a lot of authors on there. There's some really successful authors on there who are giving advice. Mike Krause, who, he's just doing amazing work at the minute. He wrote a post on there. I got him to write a post all about his process of serialized fiction. And that was such a great post. There's so much information in there. So having people who are willing to look at each other's blurbs on Amazon and, you know, really help each other. And that's, it's still building, and I want it to be a better community. And it will be, because I think people are getting, you know, more active on there, and it's not just, you know, it felt for a while like I was leading the posts in terms of, you know, I was the one doing stuff and everyone was responding, but now it feels like people are sharing and going, oh, you know, share your Facebook page here, we'll all like each other's Facebook page. And it's just little things like that. And,
yeah,
you know, asking questions about how to write a good blurb, or, you know, does this promo site work for this genre? And it's been really useful.
In terms of, I don't know if I remember this group. What's the group called?
It's called Authors of the Apocalypse.
I need to add it. I'd like to, I need to find, I've been looking for a while, somewhere as you're writing a post-apocalyptic book and you're trying to think of, like a quick research, like idea of, is diesel, like how long does diesel last before it expires? Or, you know, something like simple like that. And you need somewhere to ask where people might know. Is there any of that sort of going on?
There's been a little bit, and I think there'll be enough people on there who've researched it that they'll be able to answer it.
Yeah, that's cool.
So yeah, I think it's a really good place for things like that, definitely.
Because I'm at the point where we're going to have to go live in the woods for a bit to just to get a good idea of what I'm writing. Yeah, man. So you've been writing obviously as a journalist and now as an author. Have you got any advice for writers that maybe you wish somebody gave you but never did?
Just know when to let go of that first novel. I think when you write your first novel, it is, you go in there and you think, well, I've read a million novels, I know how to write a novel, and you don't. I think you go in there and you stick to it. I mean, some people spend 20 years on a novel, and that breaks my heart, because we've all got so many stories within us. The first novel is like your first love, or, you know, it's your first sexual experience, where it's like, this is built up for ages and I just really want to get it done, and it's got to be the best thing ever. And then you just,
you say you need to get it out there.
2 minutes.
It takes a lot longer to write a book.
Yeah. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, it's the excitement, and it's the, you know, you've just got to get it done and get it out of your system, and then move past it and know that, okay, it's going to be crap. I'm not as good as I think I am. I don't know how to tell a story. And then once you've written that first book, got it out of your system, then go and learn about story. Go and deconstruct stories that you like, stories that you hate. Work out why things work, why things don't. When you sit and watch a movie and go, I wouldn't have done that, stop yourself and go, well, why wouldn't you have done that?
Yeah.
And try and work out, you know, it's a process. And stories are deceptively simple, I think. I think we experience them all the time. We take them for granted, but they're really hard to get right. So, yeah, I think, yeah, get the novel out of your system, move on, and then really learn your craft and hone it.
Yeah.
Learn how to put stories together, learn what works, and then learn how to write. I mean, the amount of authors I see who can't string a sentence together in terms of grammar and things like that, it's weird, because even when the grammar's bad and even when the writing's bad, story is the most important thing. I mean, we can just point to 50 Shades of Grey. If a story resonates with a lot of people, it's successful regardless of the quality of writing. So get the story right first, and then, you know, do it as credit to yourself to learn how to write, where a comma goes, you know, what a past tense is, because some people don't, and that's a shame.
Yeah.
feel sorry for E.L. James. She's like the universal punching bag of authors.
Yeah, and she's probably sitting in a massive swimming pool kind of laughing.
Yeah,
But yeah, it completely highlights your point. It is more about the story. The amount of stories that I have read where it's been professionally published authors and you sit there and go, this isn't amazingly written, but oh my God, I do just want to read more.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's like most of the journey, but you know, when you get a good story and the prose is just so good. It's just adds something extra to it. It takes it to a whole other level.
So I reread, what was it, The Name of the Wind recently, the Patrick Rothfuss. And
I need to read that. I've been recommended that by so many people.
Yeah, like I love the story, but then the writing, he's just got such a poetic voice with his writing. It really adds to it. So, yeah. Even though the character's a complete dick, you're like, oh, this is really nice. This is just sounds beautiful.
It's a beautiful dick you're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. So any other mediums that you'd like to write in?
Radio. Yeah, I'd love to write radio. I mean, I've written radio plays in the past. I really like radio plays. I really like audio. It was weird. It was when I did Wizard of the Wasteland, I got the ebook and I got the print book and it was okay, fair enough. But then when somebody actually did the narration for the audiobook, because pretty much 95% of my reading now is done through audio, it just meant so much more. So yeah, audio and radio, that'd be awesome. So if anyone's listening.
you mentioned a few times about your sort of vision impairment. How has that hindered your writing, if it has at all?
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say it hasn't, but it really has. I think in a way I see it as I'm visually impaired, so screw you, I'll show you kind of thing. I think it does give me that extra drive to do it. I did a PhD in art history, and I'm visually impaired. So it was almost like it's probably like a real terrible psychological thing to have that attitude. But it was just like, well, I'm not going to let this beat me. I dictate when I'm writing most of the time. Now I use Dragon, and that's really good in terms of my biggest problem now is eye strain. And when I used to work at the newspapers, I would go home on a Friday night and pretty much lie in bed recovering until Sunday, because it just really was like being punched in the head and the eyes and whatever. And my wife's really glad now that I'm doing this, because I can just walk away from a screen, or I can just, look away. I can dictate into my mobile and have a walk up the beach. We moved to Morecambe, and this was all part of it. It's just, we tried to make our lives, all the things we wanted in our lives. I wanted to live by the sea, wanted to be a science fiction writer, and here we are. There's little things like this is why, if I wasn't, if I didn't have the eye strain issue, then, my output per month would probably be 100,000 words. I could quite comfortably do that if I didn't have to sit in front of a screen. I find editing, self-editing, really difficult. And so what I do is I basically convert what I do to Kindle and then play it back using the kind of Stephen Hawking voice. Once I've got it sounding how I want it, because this is, a lot of what I do is audio, so it has to sound right to me, the rhythm. I hate clunkiness in sentences. I hate tripping over words. And then my last edit will be getting my wife to read it out to me, and she's an English teacher and she teaches language and she's trained to be an editor. So she picks out everything that's there. And yeah, the last book was very clean. So I was pleased with how that was. And she obviously got stuff at the end, like what you call them, like pluralized singulars or something. All the little kind of technical things where I just think, oh, whatever.
How does it sound? So, yeah. That's all I care about, yeah.
I really struggle with telling if a quote mark is one of the smart ones, like the curly ones rather than straight. And sometimes I can't see the difference between full stops and commas. And, so it's just kind of little things like that where you can't hear them. But, yeah, as long as I've got another pair of eyes, then I can do this forever. So, yeah.
Cool. So I've just got a couple more questions before we jump into the quickfire round. I just want to quickly ask, first of all, have you got any sort of favorite recent books that you read or films or comics or anything that's out there that
you've
really enjoyed recently?
Well, you know, the series that I'm on at the minute is amazing. I've absolutely loved it. It's Brian McKellen's Powder Mage series. I don't know if you've read this. I think it's Flintlock fantasy is what it's described. It's basically fantasy set, I don't know, almost Regency times, and it's kind of out of the medieval setting, and there's, what is it, you've got mages who can control the path of bullets and have an affinity with gunpowder and stuff like this, and all the old wizards are kind of pissed off with these new wizards coming along and having all these new powers and things, and it's just a real kind of deep political stuff going on, a lot of stuff about I think the guy must have read a lot of Marx. Basically, there's a lot of undercurrent of like Marxist theory and just kind of unions and war, and I don't know, there's just so much going on, and it's just really well told. So yeah, I'm about an hour and a half away from the ending of that. So I'll probably finish that tonight. And yeah, really excited about that series. I think it's brilliant. Cool. So yeah, highly recommend that one.
Cool. And also, like, what other than the Black Death series, what's next for John?
I've mentioned the kind of lit RPG, visual impairment thing. So that's an ongoing thing. And then I've been doing this world building for an epic fantasy for a few years, and I've got the outlines, it's all ready to go, and it's just justifying, you know, the time of being able to do a 300,000 word trilogy. So once I've got this done with the post-apocalyptic stuff, I'm going to be writing this epic fantasy thing, and I'm really excited about it because I've done quite a few short stories in the world, and they're kind of the best received things I've had. Like, people have really gone out of the way to email me and just say, this character is awesome, you need to write more with this character. And it's like, I can't ignore that. You know, it's there's obviously a call for what this character, something about this character has resonated or whatever. So yeah, I'm going to write that series, and yeah, I've just been writing more short stories, and it just to kind of get my head back into the world. But yeah, no, that's next. Yeah.
Fantastic. Cool. Dan, have you got any more questions before we jump into the quick fire round?
The only one that, one of the things that caught me, you were saying a minute ago about when you're talking about your process, it sounds like you, I don't want to say lean on, but your wife is very supportive of what you do. Is that something that has kind of been from the start? Are you finding now that sort of your numbers are justifying your work that it's now a bit easier to sort of validate what you're doing?
You know what? She's always been supportive of whatever I do. She doesn't necessarily like it, but no, she's always very supportive. I think a lot of my artistic projects in the past, she's not really cared for necessarily, but she's always been supportive. You know, when I was in this weird experimental band, the German one I mentioned earlier, So she would not come to the gigs. She went to one and was like, I'm not coming to any more, but she used to give me lifts, and you know, she'd be there and pick me up and whatever. So you know, and just with the, you know, she's an English teacher, and she likes literary fiction, and you know, mostly literary fiction probably written about 100 years ago, and so the stuff I'm doing isn't at all something she would like, and sometimes she's just like, are you sure this is right? You know, it's, that just doesn't feel like you're doing any foreshadowing. It's like, well, I am. It's like, you know, it's just different to, you know, what Thomas Hardy is doing or whatever. So yeah. And it's kind of weird because, you know, I've really studied the genre, and I've studied what works, and like especially like the reviews of Night of the Wasteland, I think all of them bar one have been 5-star reviews, and people have loved what I've done because I'm trying to write to those readers. And you know, when I show her that, she's just like, okay, I just don't get it then, obviously. So yeah. But she'll, you know, she's there reading it and will point stuff out, like, well, I didn't hear you have this here, or you know, all those kind of little continuity details and grammatical stuff. And just, she's really good when it comes to just kind of turns of phrase, and like, she got really annoyed with one of my characters because of the way her language kept fluctuating, because I've basically got a character in a new book that is a little girl who has had a lot of trauma, and when she's kind of closing in on trauma, it's almost like she almost goes into this really simplistic state of language. And I think once she realized that that's what I was doing, she was really happy with it, but it was, yeah. It was. She couldn't be more, well, I mean, she could be more supportive, obviously. She could do whatever.
She could buy the books.
Now she's great. So, yeah, can't complain.
Cool. Okay, so the quickfire round. We've got 10 questions for you. You've got about 5 seconds at the most to answer each and every one. Are you ready?
Go on, then.
Okay, Dan, do you want to go first or would you like me to go first?
After you.
Second to last book you read?
It'll be one of the Powder Mage ones. There we go. First Powder Mage book.
Sure. PlayStation or N64?
Ooh. Probably PlayStation because of the Final Fantasy IX.
What's your favourite alcoholic beverage?
I'm currently drinking Jura, so single malt whiskey.
Nice. What's your favourite UK city?
Probably Leeds, I'd have to say.
First book you ever read?
Oh, God. Probably The Witches by Roald Dahl.
Nice.
The one person you'd want to meet?
Living or dead.
Either?
Probably China Mayville. I just think I'd have a really long, in-depth... I'd like a long, in-depth conversation with China Mayville.
Biggest hobby outside of writing?
I enjoy professional wrestling.
Who's your favourite writer?
You can't ask that. Probably Gene Wolfe, but my God. Ernest Hemingway. I mean, yeah, the list goes on. Ask me tomorrow, it'll be different. But yeah, millions of... Yeah.
So, you're in the cinema, you're waiting for a film to come on. Bad news, it's the worst film you're ever going to see. What's it called?
Duck in the City.
And where can we follow you and your work?
JohnCronshaw.com is my website. That's JohnCronshaw, because I didn't think to have a pen name and that was easy to spell when I started this. Just use my real name. JohnCronshaw.com. I've got JL Cronshaw on Twitter. And then on Facebook, it's John Cronshaw Author. I also do a podcast called John Cronshaw's Author Diary, which I launched, I think, 2 or 3 weeks ago at the moment. And it's basically I'm going to chronicle my writing career from now on and answer questions. So if you have any questions, please email john@johncronshaw.com and I'll answer them on the show.
Cool. Sounds good. And is there any sort of final plugs you want to give out to people? Maybe get people to go buy a book or give you some sort of rating or review on iTunes? I don't know. Anything out there?
If people are interested, I mean, you know, visit my website, check out the... I've got a free novella called Addict to the Wasteland. Check that out first. You know, if you don't like it, then don't bother looking at the rest of my series. But if you do, then that's kind of what the feel of my series is. It isn't the big kind of action explosions. It's a new take on post-apocalyptic fiction, I feel. And a lot of people seem to like it and then some people don't. So if you like it, then you'll enjoy the rest of the series.
I love your just blatant honesty. It's just refreshing.
Yeah.
But it's absolutely
sorry,
the attitude
it's the
you should
best
have.
Book you'll ever read.
There you go. So you used
enjoy
to.
It. if you like it, you'll like it, and if you don't, then you know. So if I can wheedle out those people who won't like it before they start leaving bad reviews on Amazon, then all the better.
And that's what every author should understand.
Yeah. Cool. So just a quick thanks to Disaster Piece for the intro and outro music, Acast for hosting the podcast, the listeners for listening, our patrons over at patreon.com/hawkandcleaver. And thank you, Dan, my co-host, for being here. Without you, I'd be alone. So thank you for that.
Thank you, Luke.
And a final thank you to John Cronshaw. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, John.
No worries.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Story Studio podcast. Still hungering for some podcast goodness? Then why not check out our other show, The Other Stories? Oh, and did you know? Every time you leave us a review in the iTunes store, a puppy is born. you they, anyway, toodle pip.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.